Welcome to What is Going Om for new thought from the edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgbeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgbeer.
Hello. How's your day going? Are you looking forward to doing something fun with friends or loved ones later? Well, what if I were to tell you that there might not be a later? That any second now, your cell phone is going to start buzzing with an emergency alert to seek immediate shelter. A ballistic missile is heading your way. No one knows where it's come from or how much time you've got. It could be 30 minutes or it could be 3. What are you going to do? Who are you going to call? Where are you going to shelter? Sounds like a description for a new disaster movie or video game, right? Wrong. This is precisely what happened to people living in Hawaii on January the 13th, 2018. Today's guest, Cynthia Lazaroff, was among them. An award-winning documentary filmmaker, producer, writer, and environmental activist who'd spent the previous year interviewing and being reawakened to nuclear dangers by many officials and experts in the US and Russia, including former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and former US Secretary of Defense William Perry. Cynthia Lazaroff was in no doubt that we are at a greater risk of a nuclear catastrophe today that at any time in history. She understood the horrific details of nuclear war, nuclear weapons, Hiroshima, fallout, and nuclear winter. But she didn't know what it would feel like to be in that situation until she experienced the visceral terror of 38 long minutes, not knowing what was going to happen. And she realized how unprepared she was, how unprepared we all are for nuclear war. Cynthia Lazaroff joins us today to share her story, not as a fearful wake-up call, but as a gift, an offering, a prayer to awaken and to take action through love, not fear. Cynthia Lazaroff, welcome.
Sandy, thank you. That was so beautiful. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
Cynthia, tell us, what was it like to live through that horrendous experience?
Well, Sandy, you know, I had stopped worrying about nuclear war after the Berlin Wall came down and the Cold War ended. And all of that changed for me in 2017 when I worked on this film and interviewed many of the top experts in the U.S. and Russia about nuclear dangers and U.S.-Russia relations. And the two people who really awakened me the most to the staggering nuclear danger that we're in today were former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and our former Secretary of Defense William Perry. And you know, Secretary Perry said to me that we're at a greater risk today than at any time in history of a nuclear catastrophe, and that most of us are blissfully unaware of this danger and that we're sleepwalking into a nuclear catastrophe and must wake up. And that was a sort of devastating revelation to me at that time. And I came home after doing these interviews in December of 2017 at the height of the fire and fury between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. And nuclear tensions were particularly high here in Hawaii because we knew that we had been marked on Pyongyang's nuclear map of death. And we were actually getting instructions from our government as to how to prepare for a nuclear attack and how to survive a nuclear attack. So all of this was present in my awareness on that morning in January of 2018, January 13th. And I was sitting in my living room when I was one of over a million people across the Hawaiian Islands who got this message on my cell phone: ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. And at first, Sandy, it was just, is this real? So So we started to try calling 911. But we couldn't get through because everybody was trying to dial 911. And so my partner, Bruce, said to me, I don't know if this is real or not, but I'm going to go get the girls. Our younger daughters were 7 miles away in the town of Kapa'a. And so he rushed to go out the door. And I said, wait a second. We need a plan if it is real of where we're going to meet. And he said, call me in the car and we'll figure it out. So when he left, I just stood there feeling stunned. And I thought, who do I know who's going to know? Who's going to know if this is real or not? And I immediately thought of our dear friend, Felicia Calvin, who is a journalist, and she knows everyone, and everyone takes her phone call. So I started to try to call her. I left a message. I texted her. I looked on her Facebook page, and there was nothing. And after what seemed like an eternity, she called back, and she said, Cynthia, the county is telling us to take shelter. And it was at that moment that I thought, my God, this is real. The county runs everything here. That's our government. And so I immediately thought, where are we going to go? There are no designated nuclear shelters in the state of Hawaii. And so we have a neighbor who has a meditation cave nearby in a cliff. And that was the most sealed environment that we could think of. So we agreed to shelter there. And then it was, what do I take with me? And I looked at my cell phone, and it had 12% charge, and I thought, oh, no. And so then I thought, there are lights in the cave. Maybe there's an outlet. Okay. And I grabbed a bag, and I threw my phone charger and my phone and my computer charger and then my purse and my passport. And then I thought, okay, I'll get a shawl to wrap around my face in case of radiation. And then leggings to cover my legs for the same reason. And then I thought, what about food and water? And I thought, I've done nothing to prepare my family for this. We were supposed to have a gallon of water per person per day for 2 weeks and enough canned food per person per day for 14 days. And I looked on the shelf and I had 2 small bottles of water and I threw them in the bag. And then I grabbed a bunch of bananas on the counter and I threw them in the bag, and then I rushed to the car. And even though the cave is only about a 7-minute walk, I didn't know how many minutes I had. So I started to drive off, and it was only at that moment that I allowed myself to think of my daughter in Los Angeles who had just left a few days before. And if I thought about her a moment sooner, I probably would have been able to hold it together. But I started to try to call her, and I thought, I've got to let her know, and I've got to say goodbye, and I've got to connect with her. And I have terrible cell service in this area, so I was ringing spottily, and I kept trying to get through and couldn't get through. And finally, I parked the car, and I started running towards the steps to the cave, and it was still ringing. And just as I got to the foot of the steps to the cave, she picked up, and I said, Mackenzie, I don't know if you've heard or not, but we've all gotten this message on our cell phone that we're going to be hit by a ballistic missile and we're going to shelter in the cave. And I'm going to call you again from the cave if I can. And I just want you to know that I love you. And she said, Mom, I love you too. And it was at that moment that kind of time stopped and I didn't want to let her go. And I just stood there and suddenly I thought, well, wait a second, what if this isn't just about Mackenzie and me? What if this isn't just about one nuclear missile from North Korea? Maybe what if this is the beginning of one of those accidental nuclear wars that all the experts were telling me about? What if this is many nuclear missiles coming from Russia and many nuclear missiles from the United States headed back that way? What if this is the beginning of the end of everything we know and love and cherish on this earth? And then I heard, Mom, go! Coach, Mackenzie jolted me out of this, and I said, I love you, and I started running up the steps to the cave. And then the hill above the steps, and as I got to the door of the cave, the door opened, and it was my neighbor calling, and she was smiling, and she held up her cell phone, and she said, it was a false alarm. Even with everything I knew about nuclear war and nuclear weapons and the danger and fallout and radiation, Hiroshima, nuclear winter, nuclear war was unimaginable to me until I went through those 38 minutes. And now it really lives inside of me. It's part of me. I had it was a gut punch, a visceral wake-up call. And as a mother, as a human being, it's not going to leave me until we eliminate nuclear weapons. So that's why I'm here with you today, Sandy. That's why I'm doing this work.
But you've always been attracted to Russia. You've spent many years in Russia. You have done all kinds of wonderful work, getting Russian and American youth together to understand one another. You know, what made you turn away from that? I mean, you say that you thought that after the Berlin Wall came down, that, you know, the Cold War was over and the world was safe. And then what made you then, you know, what woke you up to the horrors that were still out there? I mean, it's just an incredible story, Cynthia. Incredible story. Just the very fact that you were making this movie and then you had this experience.
Well, you know, Sandy, it really, that was kind of the sense. It was, wait a second, can this really be happening to me, having just been reawakened? And I was, you know, when expert after expert reawakened me to what I call the staggering nuclear danger, I had this feeling of, how can it be possible that not only are we back to where we were then during the Cold War, but it's worse, they're telling us, for so many reasons. And it was actually keeping me awake at night, and I thought, at least back then, we were all aware of this. Today, very few people have this on their minds. And so that even makes us at a greater danger, because we don't know it's a problem. We are sleepwalking. And so that was a wake-up call in and of itself, but it was very, it was very strange. It was almost, you know, the chances of my, first of all, re-engaging in this work after all these years and having been asked to work on this film in 2017, when I was actually, my sort of work during the Cold War, to go back to your answer to your question, I really felt like I so longed to want to work on my other passion, which is my love for Mother Earth and the sea and coral reefs. And so I thought when the Cold War was over, I could go and do that work. And that's what I was doing. And I was planning to do that work for the rest of my life. And so this came very, very strangely to me that I would, first of all, be reawakened and then find myself here in Hawaii, where I only moved a few years before. I'd only moved here in 2015. So that I was here in Hawaii, and even that morning, my phone was on silent. But our nephew was here, and he came running in, and he shoved the phone in my partner's face and was panting and panting. And if he hadn't been here, I would have never seen the message on my cell phone, which I went to go see if it was on my phone too, because we weren't sure whether he was hacked. So we were all these things that kind of lined up
all these
for that moment. There were synchronicities that I'd never expected to be living in Hawaii. I never expected to be reengaged in this work. I, as I said, so many people slept through it that morning, never knew that it happened or had their phones on silent. And all of these things kind of lined up so that I, having just been reawakened, really had an experience that was unlike most of the other people in Hawaii, because I knew the danger. I'd been awakened. I knew what was at stake.
So do you see some higher power, some other hand at work here?
Well, I just can say humbly that I felt like I had been searching for, I've been asking myself the question, how does one possibly break through on this issue at this millisecond news cycle? At this time, how do we possibly reach people that was my kind of prayer and my question every night, having been reawakened by the experts, what do we do? And when this came to me, it was a feeling of, this is a gift. This is the answer to your prayer. This is something that you can share. And in fact, you know, after this happened, it was like I'd been reborn again. It was when I walked away from the cave and I felt the wind on my cheeks. I'd never felt the wind that way before. It was almost kissing my cheeks. I looked up at the palm trees and it was like they were dancing. They were so beautiful. The sound, everything was enhanced, my senses. The sound of the ocean was, the roar was so reassuring. The colors of everything were so vibrant. I felt like I was a child again. It was really, for me and hundreds of thousands of us, like a near-death experience. So for me, it was this feeling of, I'm still here. This gratitude, this is a gift, and I need to do something with it. And then I got this strong urging, this voice said, you need to write this down. You need to share this. Yeah. Right now, while it's
fresh.
I'm
going to hold you there, moment to moment. Cynthia, I'm going to hold you right there. We want to know more about that article you wrote. We'll hear about that when we come back from the break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest today is award-winning documentary filmmaker, producer, writer, and environmental activist Cynthia Lazarev, whose article, Dawn of a New Armageddon, chronicles her personal experience of the Hawaii missile scare in 2018. Which led to the co-foundation of Nuclear Wake Up Call. We'll be back with more from Cynthia after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio. IOM FM.
Brought to you by CDC and the Ad Council.
With so much loss, you may feel like you can't handle it all. Meditation or other spiritual practices can help you feel more grounded and better able to cope.
Find more self-care and coping tips at coping-19.org.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Vox Novus, the new voice. Vox Novus, the new dimension. Vox Novus, thought and movement leaders who will share from their experience and offer tools to help us navigate our rapidly changing world. My name is Victor Furman. Join me every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern on OM Times Radio for Vox Novus, the new voice.
Mental health. Most people think it means mental illness. Most people are wrong. Mental health doesn't apply to just some of us. It applies to everyone. We're all susceptible to anxiety and depression. They're human conditions. And no person should ever feel embarrassed, ashamed, or be discriminated against for being human. Cracked the Podcast strips away the shame, fear, and stigma by expanding the conversation into areas less often visited. From brain and body chemistry, hormones, food, nutrition, trauma, and the microbiome, to pharmaceutical drugs, psychedelic substances, meditation, visionary experiences, and spiritual awakenings. Cracked, the podcast, will explore them all, including the notion that, for many, breakdown can be the beginning of breakthrough. For in the words of singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, there is a crack in everything. It's where the light gets in. Cracked, the podcast, slaying the dragons of mental health. Join co-hosts Sandy Sedgbeer and Rebecca Shaper on the first and third Thursday of every month at 12 noon Eastern Time.
Came across someone struggling with hunger. How would you recognize them?
By their clothes.
Their age.
The way they speak.
Hunger can be hard to recognize. Learn why at IamHungerInAmerica.org. Brought to you by Feeding America, 200 Food Banks Strong, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Cynthia Lazarev, you wrote Dawn of a New Armageddon, which was published in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists on Hiroshima Day. What was the reaction to your article?
You know, Sandy, it was, people were really moved and inspired. It was such a wonderful response. I mean, the outpouring from people all over the world, including in Russia, including in people from many of the nuclear armed countries. And it really went all over. And it was published, they published it in Russia on the cover of the independent daily Kommersant, and it was on the front page for an entire weekend. And so it really touched hearts. And people were saying, there was an anthropologist at Stanford that was saying, you know, we need a graphic reminder of what the risk is here. And I think that the article, you know, really touched that. It really, it personalized this very technical world of nuclear weapons. People hear the word nuclear weapons and they think, oh, that's nuclear experts. They think, oh, that's something out there. That's something of the past. But it made it personal. It was a human story. You know, it brought it into the home of being a mother, of being a human being, of reaching out to say, you know, to call my daughter to say goodbye and I love you. That was the moment that I think touched people the most, and it still does. And but it was something that everybody was calling people to say, I love you. That there was so much love that came through in this moment of what we thought was the end. That's what was most precious came through. And that's really, you know, the article is really, I interwove what I'd learned from the experts with my experience. What was present for me in those 38 minutes was that awareness of what all those different possibilities could be, of what could be going wrong in that moment. And so it brings that awareness of the danger, but puts it in the context of one's personal moment-to-moment experience of what it's like to have 38 minutes to feel like the world is going to come to an end. And this has now become one of the classic historical false alarms in the nuclear world, along with the very well-known cases of accidental nuclear war that have happened, of the risk of false alarms of accidental nuclear war that happened throughout the Cold War. And we've had over 1,000 false alarms over the decades of the nuclear age. So this is now one of those, a different kind of false alarm.
Well, the law of averages, you know, 1,000 of them, one of them soon might not be. I mean, this whole experience galvanised you. You started the website nuclearwakeupcall.earth. You started At the Brink podcast. In that podcast, you actually spoke to former US Secretary of Defence William Perry. He talks about the dangerous nuclear false alarm that he experienced in the Pentagon in 1979. There was another one in 1983. I mean, these false alarms seem to have to happen every so often to make people realize exactly what we're doing.
You know, they really, the false alarm really woke up Secretary Perry and really has impacted his life. And I was very honored to be interviewed actually by his granddaughter for that podcast At the Brink with Secretary Perry on the same episode. And I think that when one goes through something like this, it's a life-changing experience. And Secretary Perry is, you know, dedicating his life at age 90-something with, I think, 12 great-grandchildren or grandchildren at this point who are working to eliminate the threat of nuclear war. That's what his whole life is dedicated to. And I know that his experience of the false alarm impacted him, as it has so many who have been in that situation. So, and I think that's what is probably the greatest concern for those of us when I ask other nuclear experts, what keeps you awake at night? I think one of the things is this risk of an accidental nuclear war. That's very prominent. There are many other nuclear dangers today that we didn't have during the Cold War. but this is the one that has been with us for all this time.
So, nuclear wake-up call, what is the purpose of it? And tell us about some of the initiatives that you're involved in now.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened as I was writing the article was this feeling of, well, this isn't just about sharing the experience to awaken. There's got to be action. You know, action has to come hand in hand with awakening. And the other feeling was that I couldn't just leave people in despair, that I had to offer them hope for things that they could do. And so I looked at what the recommendations were from many of the people that I interviewed, like Gorbachev, like Secretary Perry, like many of the nuclear experts in the field and many NGOs. And I put together something called the Nuclear Playbook. And so that has 10 steps of recommendations inspired by all those I've just mentioned, of ways that we can both reduce the nuclear risk and work towards the elimination of nuclear weapons. So that experience of looking at what we could do and the experience of writing the article led me to feel like I personally needed to carry on the work beyond the article. And so in starting Nuclear Wake-Up Call.Earth, also founding it on the day that the article came out on the anniversary of the United States bombing of Hiroshima, August 6th, this is in 2018, I really sought to look at what I could do. I asked myself what kind of difference could I make? So one was, of course, sharing the story to share as a prayer, as an offering for awakening to others. But also it was offering people ways that they could make a difference through the playbook. Then a large part of the work has been focused on Russia and engaging Russia, nuclear risk reduction conversations, ways that we can work together to avoid a nuclear war, and all different ways of reaching out. Because the U.S. and Russia have over 90% of the world's nuclear weapons still today. And because we are the two largest nuclear powers, it's really incumbent upon us to take the lead to encourage others to follow. China has recently said they will not consider reducing their nuclear arsenals, which are a fraction of the size of our arsenals, until we come down to their level. We together have over 12,000 of the world's 13,500 nuclear weapons. China has 320. And so it was this, because I have this whole history with Russia that goes back to really my childhood, I felt like that was an area where I could make a difference. And so we do education, we do outreach. I take people through simulations of going through this kind of nuclear false alarm. I Photoshop in Moscow, the message we got on our cell phones, or in Washington, and people have the experience of the awakening. Also doing things like cultural exchanges, people to people. And we did a concert with Hawaii artist Makana, an activist, and we took him really as a way to open hearts at a very, very challenging time in relations. It's been a very, very one of the most difficult low points in relations since the Cold War over the last few years during the Trump administration, really starting in 2014 with the events that took place in Crimea. As relations have deteriorated, the nuclear risk goes up. That's sort of just the proportion. And so these efforts are designed to look for ways to reduce tensions, to connect people, like we did during the Cold War. We did a lot of citizen diplomacy, and to really open people's hearts. And Makana, through his singing, through his sharing of aloha and indigenous wisdom, really touched people's hearts. And we were there at a time when it was particularly, the tensions were really high because we were announcing our withdrawal from the Intermediate Nuclear Range Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty. And he was able to bring music into the halls of, you know, the Diplomatic Academy of the Foreign Ministry when we were having discussions about nuclear risk reduction, and the whole tone changed because we brought music into the room. So another project that I'm working on, again, asking the question like we did during the Cold War, what is meant to happen here? What can break through? What has the capacity to break through? Through a series of synchronicities, this vision came to bring Indigenous peoples together in the Bering Strait. There are Indigenous peoples living on the Alaskan side and on the far in the Siberian side, the Chukotkin side, who are members of the same tribe, who are artificially separated by the border between our two countries, where it's less than 3 miles apart. And so, and there are issues now of climate change that are shared in the Bering Strait. It's a place of strategic rivalry. It's a place for, because of the melting ice, a place of, increased competition for resources. It's a place where we've had military intercepts on both sides, on the air and at sea. So it's a place of potential conflict. And so this vision came forth through so many people, shared vision, to bring Indigenous peoples together. So we're going to be doing that on the solstice in 2022. And as a vision for peace, it's called Bering Strait for Peace. And we'll be coming together in boats in the middle of the Bering Strait on the border and starting a joint project for climate change, doing things to call attention to our capacity to work together, to cooperate, to dissolve the artificial barriers, to make it possible, like it once was, for these separated families from the same tribe to cross the strait freely again. So that's another project that I'm working on.
You're also convening an international online mentoring program to empower women to transform our nuclear legacy. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, Sandy, this is another one of those situations that where there are synchronicities in that this was not a project that I thought of from my head. It's a project that really chose me. There were, in the summer of 2019, while I was hosting a series of events for the Bering Strait Project with Indigenous elders here in Hawaii, and I was very busy, four young women, none of whom knew each other, none of whom had ever done anything with nuclear weapons, who had either come to a talk or had read the Dawn of a New Armageddon article, all in the space of about a week, came to me and asked me the question, will you mentor me in this work? And one of them, this beautiful Native Hawaiian activist here on the island of Kauai, Mahina, she said to me, and she started to cry and said, do you think I can have a voice in this work? And I said to her, Mahina, if nuclear weapons can destroy all of us, we all have a role and a stake and a role to play in eliminating them. And we all all of our lives are at stake. And so that was how the project, that seed was planted. And I really didn't have a moment to think about it until I broke my ankle about a week after all of these events. And I was sitting down, stopped, cold, icing my ankle, elevating it on the couch, and I thought, I suddenly remembered these four young women who had come to me, and I said, okay, what does this mean? I better pay attention to this. And that's how the project was born. And it is really an opportunity for women from all over the world to come together, to be informed, inspired, and empowered to claim our seats at the table to eliminate nuclear weapons. Because women from the dawn of the nuclear age have been at worst completely or at best largely excluded from nuclear policy making and nuclear decision making. And we're still grossly underrepresented in this field. And so that was all in the background here. But it's absolutely essential, and I mean, it's existential, that women have been excluded since the beginning of the nuclear age for most of this work, I think has brought us to the brink of possible extinction. So there's a recognition in the field of the need to address this imbalance. So that was in the background. And I started to talk to people about this idea. And across the spectrum of the nuclear space, everyone said, yes, this is something that we really need and could really potentially make a difference and be game-changing. And so we are gathering women, both newcomers, and it's really, really purposed to engage newcomers, but also women doing all kinds of things in the nuclear space, ranging from working in traditional security and arms control and diplomacy to working on nuclear risk reduction to people who are dedicated solely to eliminating nuclear weapons. And so we're bringing these women together in online mentoring sessions. We've had three so far. And we have had women now from over 38 countries, from 8 of the 9 nuclear armed states, and it's so inspiring. It's just so, so inspiring.
It is indeed. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with award-winning filmmaker, producer, writer, and environmental activist Cynthia Lazaroff about her personal experience of the terrifying Hawaii missile scare in 2018, which put into sharp focus the need for us all to wake up to the existential risks confronting humanity today. We'll be back with more from Cynthia Lazaroff after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times' flagship radio show, What Is Going On. As a long-time editor, book judge, spiritual magazine publisher and radio host, I've read thousands of books and interviewed hundreds of authors and teachers, so I know what's worth reading and what isn't. Now, with the spiritual book market growing increasingly crowded, more and more people are seeking my help in finding the authentic voices, the empowering tools, and the genuine skip the BS guidance that will make the most difference to their spiritual development. So I decided to make it easier by bringing my knowledge, experience, and considerable network of contacts together in the No BS Spiritual Book Club. There are no ads, no joining fees, no obligations, and no BS. Just an ever-growing library compiled by recognisable and respected names of the 10 best books that help them the most on their journeys. Plus, free book excerpts, audios, and live video interviews where you can quiz them about their spiritual journeys and their 10 best list choices. Your time and money are valuable, your spiritual journey even more so. If you're looking for genuine guidance from people who have walked this path before you, check out sedgbeer.com. Click on the No BS Spiritual Book Club tab and join the club. That's sedgbeer.com, sedgbeer.com. I'll see you there.
The Equal Justice Initiative, we believe mass incarceration has to end. We have to confront our history of racial injustice and commit to a new era of truth. And the truth can inspire change. Please learn more at EJI.org.
Welcome back. Cynthia Lazaroff, in a world where everyone has become either terrified or emotionally paralyzed by the specter of the COVID pandemic, how do you wake people up and get them to take seriously yet another existential threat like nuclear war? I mean, how much more can people cope with? How do you get them to listen?
Sandy, that's a really good question. It was hard enough before the pandemic, and yet there is an intersectionality here to this issue. When we think about the cost of nuclear weapons and the spending on nuclear weapons every year, and in the last year that we have the data for, 2019, that's published, is we spent $73 billion on nuclear weapons, and the United States spent over half of that, and an estimated $1.9 trillion on militarism globally. When you think about the cost of nuclear weapons and that they do nothing to address the existential threats of our time of the pandemic and climate change, they don't make us more secure. In fact, as we've been talking about, they make us less secure because of the nuclear risk. It's absolutely insane that we still have them. And so we speak to the intersectionality, and the young ones who are doing this work do this so beautifully. Nuclear weapons, basically, we have more nuclear warheads in the United States than hospitals at a time when we have suffered shortages of essential medical supplies. It's clear that our priorities are absolutely upside down, and that when people say we don't have the resources to do what we need to do for the pandemic, we don't have the resources for climate change, where do we get the money? Well, it's really, we can get the money by not building more weapon systems. We don't need these weapons. We need to eliminate them. And so I think that, you know, also, again, by sharing my story and making it personal and really letting people know that we all have this connection to this, that it can happen at any moment, that's a way. But also coming back to this idea that it's not about awakening people just to the danger, but that we all can come together in love and act out of love for life. That this isn't just about acting to eliminate. This is about acting to affirm life, to affirm our capacity to make a difference, to confirm our capacity to change the story. And those of us who have lived through the Cold War, when everyone said that would never end, that the Berlin Wall would never come down, that we were most likely going to blow each other up, that any change was going to be impossible in the Soviet Union, we've lived to see the world change. And if we did it back then, we can do it again. We have a whole host of new challenges today. But we have the experience of knowing that we can come together in love and acting out of love for life to change this story and to repurpose these resources that are being not only wasted, but just entirely misused to create weapons of mass destruction, and channel those into addressing the other existential threats that are right here in front of us that need these resources to be resolved.
You know, it's been said many times that the only thing that can unify the human race is an existential threat. Many thought that the only thing big enough would be an alien invasion. But here we are now with two existential threats: a pandemic that is affecting us all, and the threat of nuclear war. And yet what we're seeing with the pandemic is there are some moves towards unity amongst nations, and there's also a great polarization taking place and people kind of shutting themselves down and arguments. You know, do we have what it takes to really understand? Individually, we all know the power of love, but, you know, collectively, you know, do you have hope that we are going to see the craziness of this and come together?
Sandy, again, another really profound and important question that we all grapple with in this work. I think that I do have hope, because when I see the power of one person making a difference, when I see what our capacity is, I know that we are not coming together on the pandemic like we need to be. And I do feel that it's another wake-up call and another invitation for us to come together. And we, instead of competing, we should be collaborating. Instead of trying to limit and be the first ones to get the vaccine. We all need to be working together. That's part of the message of this virus, is that it, you know, if one person has, still has it, if one country is still out of control, we're all at risk. The virus doesn't recognize borders. Just like nuclear weapons, you know, when we have radiation and nuclear winter, that doesn't recognize borders. Just like climate change doesn't recognize borders. This is the larger invitation here for humanity, is that we have a choice here. It's an existential moment. It's a turning point moment. And so I do have hope because of things that have happened recently, like the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which has come into force recently at the UN just last month, which bans nuclear weapons on makes them illegal on moral grounds for the countries that are party to the treaty. I do feel that this is a rising together of people from all over the world to change the story. And it brings me great hope. You know, seeing the young ones engage and people from so many different countries coming together and saying, we're going to do this. We're going to change this story. When I see people continuing to affirm life, you know, then I feel hope. I feel inspired. And that's what keeps me going. It's all the other people. It's the women coming into Women Transforming Our Nuclear Legacy, which I would invite everyone to join, from all over the world, who are saying yes to life. Mm-hmm. So I look around me, and it's the other people who are engaging. It's the people taking care of each other. There's been so much heroism during this pandemic as well. We've seen acts of great heroism. So I celebrate those people, and I celebrate those acts of heroism, and I know that we can all aspire to that, and that's really the invitation, that's the prayer.
You've said that it feels like something wants to happen that is larger than any one of us, and that people are showing up and constellating all over the world for this work to change our story. What can we do? What can I, as one person, do? What can each of our listeners do to support this?
Well, there's so many things to do. So let me start with so I take the approach in this work that one needs to, as far as the nuclear issue goes, one needs to work wherever there's a possibility of changing the story. So if you look at the spectrum very simply, there are people who advocate arms control. There are people who advocate nuclear risk reduction or a combination. There are people who advocate eliminating nuclear weapons. I say we work on all areas. We support our governments in traditional arms control, and we encourage that conversation to continue no matter what. We encourage dialogue, and we insist that dialogue continue between and among nuclear armed states, no matter what's going on in relations, whether it's the United States and Russia, the U.S. and Iran, the United States and North Korea. We have to keep talking, and one of the sort of most dangerous things in making things more dangerous today than it was during the Cold War is we have lost largely, until recently the Biden administration restarted arms control. We've lost this safe space for arms control and nuclear risk reduction. We've got to restore that between and among all nuclear powers. And we've got to compel our politicians to do this. Right now, our politicians are endowed with making nuclear policy, our leaders. They need to hear from us on this. They need to be asked, what do you know about the nuclear risk and what are you doing about it? No one should occupy or run for office without being able to give us a good answer to that question. Everyone right now today can start informing themselves. The media is missing in action largely, except with people within the space, like the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, that are keeping us awake every day. And I would encourage people to inform themselves about the nuclear danger. Call out journalists. And during the Cold War, they constantly reminded us of the clear and present nuclear danger. They need to come back to fulfill their ethical responsibility today. Start a conversation with everybody you know, your family, your friends, people in your community. Support nuclear risk reduction measures like no first use of nuclear weapons. There is legislation for many of these measures that are in the nuclear playbook that's on the website, nuclearwakeupcall.earth. support those measures, bring them to the attention of your congressional representatives. We need to start taking action to reduce the nuclear risk and then support the treaty for the prohibition of nuclear weapons. We need the nuclear risk reduction measures to stay around long enough, and we need to make eliminating nuclear weapons, supporting the treaty, a priority. And the international campaign for the abolishment of nuclear weapons is a place to go on their website. You can get your country involved. You can get your city involved. You can get your elected representatives involved and call on them to support this treaty, which is truly a revolutionary treaty. And it's the first treaty to address the disproportionate impact of nuclear weapons on women and girls due to ionizing radiation. It's the first nuclear weapons treaty based on humanitarian, not military law. It's the first treaty to address the disproportionate impact of nuclear weapons on indigenous peoples. It's the first to really change the story. And it's been brought to the world by the countries that don't have nuclear weapons, who are basically saying to the nuclear armed states, it's time for you to fulfill your pledge that you made in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970 to end the arms race and to abolish nuclear weapons in exchange for our not proliferating nuclear weapons. And it's really an invitation to the world. So a really beautiful example is that New York City is right now in the process of divesting its pension fund from nuclear weapons. So there are all kinds of ways through divestment, and there's an organization called Don't Bank on the Bomb. That is really the way for this treaty, just like we banned cluster bombs, cluster munitions, just like we banned landmines, just like apartheid. Divestment campaign is the way forward for this treaty, and everybody can get involved in this divestment campaign, even individually in terms of where they bank. So there are so many things that we can do, and you can start to be part of things like Women Transforming Our Nuclear Legacy. I invite people to be part of that, of this online mentoring program for women and girls. I invite people to do what we did in the 1980s and conceive of, invent citizen diplomacy, reaching out to people who are our nuclear adversaries, supporting peace. There are all different ways that we can each make a difference. And that's where the hope is. It's not going to be done. Our leaders are not going to do it without us. So those are some thoughts.
Well, Cynthia, I mean, spent the entire day digging into so many of the links that you've given me, and I'm just filled with information. And it's horrific, it's alarming, it's also incredibly heartwarming, the things that are being done. I would recommend that people go to your website, nuclearwakeupcall.earth, read your article in its entirety. Also go to ICANW.org, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, because there are so many different links from there. I just want to wrap up the show with something that you said in your article. You wrote, it was the kind of wake-up call that moved President Kennedy after the Cuban Missile Crisis to reach out to the Soviet Union. It was the kind of wake-up call that shifted the thinking of both Reagan and Gorbachev. And it's the kind of wake-up call that this story of those 38 minutes, I hope, can help give to those who were not in Hawaii of January the 13th. You know, we weren't there. We don't know. But if we read your article, I'm sure we can put ourselves in your shoes and feel what you felt, even if only a small smidgen of that feeling, but that should be enough. Cynthia Lazaroff, is there anything you want to say as a final goodbye?
Well, just thank you, Sandy, and I invite everybody to claim your seat at the table to eliminate nuclear weapons, because it's going to take each and every one of us, and it's up to all of us to change this story at this time. So please find what moves you. There's so many ways to get involved and claim your seat at the table. It's there, it's waiting for you. And I bless you, and I'm just grateful.
Yeah, it's there for all of us. Cynthia Lazarus, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Sandy. It's been such a pleasure to be here.
For us too. You can learn more about Cynthia Lazaroff's work at the websites cynthialazaroff.com, nuclearwakeupcall.earth, and please check out the icanw.org website. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. I'll be back next week with another edition of What Is Going On. Till then, it's goodbye from me.